Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Here on this show, we talk a lot about building community. We invite you to call in and share your opinions on difficult, even divisive topics. And you do. You also listen. Now, sometimes, I don't know about you, but I can find it can be really hard to listen, like deeply listen, when assumptions start popping into my brain about the person that I'm listening to. Assumptions, also known as stereotypes. I wish I could get them out of my brain, but it is much easier said than done sometimes. Many stereotypes that we live with came out long before any of us were even born. Now, my colleague Myra Flynn has spent the better part of this year talking to Black men specifically about stereotypes that are applied to them. She produced a four-part series called Stereo Antitypes for the Vermont Public Podcast Homegoings. Myra is also the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging Advisor at Vermont Public, and she is joining us today to talk through what she has learned about stereotypes and introduce us to some of the people that she met along the way. Myra, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
It's always so great to be here. This one's going to be a doozy. Michaela, I can feel it.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot to talk about.
For sure.
And listeners, we hope that you will join us as well. What stereotypes did you grow up believing in? Which ones have been applied to you? Add your voice to the conversation. Give us a call this hour at 800-639-2211. You can also send us an email to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. And before we dive in, I also want to note that the conversation we're going to have is going to include some adult themes, including sex, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. So, Myra, your beat, if you will, if I could define it for
let's do that, yes.
Is nuance. It's nuanced and sometimes very difficult topics. And so it didn't totally surprise me that you were taking on a series about stereotypes. But tell us more. Where did the idea for this four-part series first come to you from?
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of the tale, like you were saying, it's a tale as old as time. Some of these have been around for so long. They're folklore, they're legend, they're mythical sometimes, but they're also so harmful. You know, even though they've been around for such a long time, they are still impacting people's lives in the here and now. And it just felt like it was time. In all of my reporting, I bump up against a stereotype or three, even if the subject is not stereotypes. So it felt fair to face them head on. And I also felt like, you know what? I'll never run out of material here. There are so many stereotypes, so many assumptions, and so much bias in how we see one another and treat each other.
And what are the four stereotypes you chose to focus on?
Sure. So we're calling them myths for the anti-types series. And so we went with the myth of the stupid Black person, the myth of the deadbeat dad, the myth of the scary Black man, and the myth of the big Black penis.
So they all focus on men. But you didn't set out to specifically do that in the series. It just kind of happened, right?
Totally. When I was pulsing folks for stereotypes that they'd heard, a lot of these ones came up. And also the ones that were most impactful and doing the most harm seemed to apply to Black men. So it ended up being a conversation with men. And I'm really happy for that because I don't know. I think some of the Black men in these episodes were surprised by what we learned together about these stereotypes as well.
Yes, and we'll get to hear from a couple folks who you interviewed later in the hour. And you also talked, Myra, to men who are in our region, in and around Vermont, and across the U.S., right?
Absolutely. I always try, you know, the show is broader than Vermont's borders. Most podcasts are. Podcasts are kind of inherently international, if you will. But I always try to include somebody of color from the state of Vermont. It's very important.
Yeah. So what was the most difficult of your four subjects to tackle?
Would you like to guess?
I think I know.
Yeah, definitely the myth of the big Black penis was most difficult. Not even just to tackle, but to kind of thread the needle of harm that's around that myth, because it's a stereotype that's dressed up as a compliment. So I find that kind of interesting. If I say the myth of the stupid black person, nobody here is like, oh, yeah, that'd be a compliment to be called stupid, right? But to say that a certain part of your body is big and well endowed and is, you know, meant for pleasure, what's wrong with that? Well, there's so much wrong with that. And a lot of it goes back to slavery, the sale of black bodies, the expectation of black men fathering children by the age of 15 and that being part of their sale. There's some science-based racism in there, a lot of testing on the black body and black men in particular for syphilis all the way up into the 70s. There's kind of this concept that black men's brains were smaller, but that their genitals were enlarged and that they were going to go out and seek vengeance upon the world for slavery by way of, you know, raping white wives. There's just so much attached to the black male body. So it felt really important to make this, and I stand behind it.
Yeah. Well, and just one more note for listeners here that we're going to be talking pretty explicitly about sex and bodies for the next 5 or so minutes, and then we'll be talking about other stereotypes in this series throughout the rest of the hour. And Myra, you did so much research into the history of this myth, as you said, starting with its roots in slavery and the sale of black bodies, and then you go all the way up to the present day talking about the porn industry. I wonder if you could kind of make that connection a little more explicit for us.
Gosh, let's see if I can do it.
And everyone should also listen to the podcast episode in full because it's fascinating and so thoughtful, as all your work usually is.
Thank you.
Always
yes,
is.
Yes, that was a big needle to thread. Yeah, so basically, it does begin with slavery here in the U.S., the stereotype. I want to get this out of the way. The myth is busted. It is a myth. Black men do not have larger penises statistically. There's no data out there that shows that they are any larger than any other penises out there in the world, right? So, but this is so interesting because it's stuck around for such a long time. And a lot of this has to do with breeding. The breeding culture that did exist in slavery and on the auction block in particular, the black male body was sometimes like greased up. Their teeth were checked. Their genitals were checked publicly for sale. The body was on full display. Sometimes they would make the slaves dance to appear healthier than they were. So there was a lot of focus on the black male body when it came to sale, when it came to its desired, you know, sale for breeding. And something like 17 children were expected to be fathered by a 15-year-old male slave. So you can imagine if you are showing larger genitals, if you are showing that maybe you'd be better for breeding, then your, you know, sale would be higher. Mm. You'd be of more value. And I think, I tried to thread this needle, but I think that the auction block still stands where the exploitation of the black male body is strong and is there and is present. And I think it's in modern day porn. And so I tried to make that connection. It's a little tough to make without seeing or researching some of what I've researched and some of what I've seen. But it is to say that, like, there is a very inhuman and inhumane way of talking about the black male body in porn. And it really does harken back to slavery in a way. In some ways, slavery is part of the fantasy.
Mm. And listeners, while we're talking about this, I'm really curious to hear what this conversation is bringing up for you. And if there are stereotypes that have been applied to you in your own life that are coming up for you right now, you can call in at 800-639-2211. Or if you prefer email, that's vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Myra, I feel like, I don't know if you agree, but I feel like at least over my lifetime, it feels like our society has gotten a little bit better about confronting some of the harmful connections that we make between women's bodies and their idea of self-worth, of, you know, having it being thin or having a certain shape and that making you a more desirable person. But with men, it feels like that conversation has moved a little bit slower, or it isn't as out in the open. I'm wondering if you felt that way too, perhaps in the conversations that you kind of convened with friends and with experts for this episode.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear. We could do a whole other series on the stereotypes that apply to women. So it's not to say that those are exempt from the conversation, but I do think like the way that men are socialized in our society, like first of all, talking about vulnerable things like this that actually like point to the pain points when it comes to their bodies directly conflicts with how men are supposed to show up in society, which is to not have any pain points, right? And to be strong. And when it comes to Black men, I mean, you don't even have to dive into the sex industry. Take a look at sports. Take a look at how they are kind of required in a way to show up in this solid, unflinching, relentlessly strong and working and, you know, kind of brutish way. And so, of course, that conversation has moved so much slower. And there's also a lot of pride in for Black men in having this strength or, you know, being great at sports or, you know, being desired as this episode showcases. But that's why I say there was a surprise there with some of the people I interviewed, because it was like, did you know that everything that you're proud of comes from something really harmful? And do you want to take a look at that? So we just need to start slowly having these conversations.
Yeah, well, then maybe you might have just answered my next question. But I really loved the part of your episode where you sat down with a bunch of guys you know on your front porch. You could hear the wind chimes in the background. And you start having this really frank conversation about male bodies, the Black male body. First, was it tough to get folks to sit down and talk with you about this? And then second, did anything surprise you about what you've heard?
Okay, so not so tough to get them, but their wives a little tough.
Like, why are you doing this to me, Myra?
I know. But I was like, no, come over. We ordered a taco kit and we sat down. And I was like, let's talk. Let's dig right in and let's talk about this. And it wasn't hard. But I think getting a moment of vulnerability was really hard. You know, it's not in the episode, but we have plenty of tape on the cutting room floor where some folks were like, I guess I could see how this could be harmful. There was this one time, you know, but for the most part, especially around each other, these men were bragging, had quite a bit of, you know, bravado around the whole myth, a lot of humor. I mean, we're doing a lot of laughing, mm-hmm. talking about one another's bodies. But two of the folks that I spoke with were family members, so there was a little bit of embarrassment between one another for talking about their bodies. But there seemed to be a lot of support in the room and not a lot of room for, I guess, like too much opening up.
Yeah. Well, you also talked not just with folks you knew, but a adult film star named Hasan Salam. He's known as King Noir. And during the episode, he talked about this idea that you brought up earlier of these quote unquote positive stereotypes and how they can still be harmful for folks like him. I want to take a listen to a portion of that conversation.
Like, I remember I saw this this cartoon. It was like on Twitter or something, and it was like Asian man, big brain, small penis. Black man, big penis, small brain. Like, I talked to like some of my Asian folk about it. And be like, yo, when I get to school, people expect me to have all the answers. That's a double-edged sword as well, when people think you're smart. But when people think you're stupid and think the only thing worth anything about you is your body, when you don't match the physical stature or you don't have that libido, you're thrown away.
That was Hasan Salam from your episode about the myth of the big Black penis. But I thought that clip was so interesting because it also kind of ties into another myth you discuss in this series about the, quote, stupid Black person. Yes. It's also intricately interwoven. And he describes it so movingly, the effect on his own self.
He absolutely does. And this is a person who, to his point, which you'll hear in the episode if you listen, says, you know, we don't speak a lot about this in my industry because it affects our bottom line, like our money. You don't want to demystify some of these myths because, you know, whatever your fantasy is, we're here to make it come true. But he actually goes around the country kind of talking very in a very revealing way about what's going on behind the sex industry when it comes to racism and how it pertains to him, like learning the word blacked. I don't know if you heard this word before, but it's a word in his industry that means if you have had sex or slept with a black person, you are now blacked or soiled. And so that actor will receive less money because of it. So, you know, he taught me quite a bit about what's going on behind the scenes and really seems to be somebody who's in it for, you know, love, you know, essentially, and believes that sex is art and thinks that there should be no room for racism. So he's a wonderful person to talk to. He seems very aware of the stereotype.
Mm. Well, if you're just joining us, we are speaking with Myra Flynn, the host and executive producer of the podcast Homegoings. She's a four-part series called Stereo Anti-Types. And we're inviting you to call in to discuss stereotypes that have affected you in particular and maybe reflect on some of the ones that we're discussing in detail today. Let's go to the phones now. We have Chris calling in from Barrie. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, hello. I was just telling your producer, I grew up, my last name ends in an S-K-I, ski, and I grew up, my father was a Polish immigrant from the Second World War. He escaped that war when he was just a boy. They were fortunate enough to get to America. But growing up during my formative years, all I heard from my peers, not from my teachers, but from my peers, my friends, my kids, were saying, you know, Polish people are stupid. Polish people are stupid. And I'm like, what is this? And it really, it kind of hurt. It really did. And what's funny is when I grew up, I got to a point where I wanted to change my name. I mean, it was so hurtful. But when I grew up and I started to learn a little bit more about the Polish culture, I really embraced it and really am very proud to call myself of Polish heritage. I'm a Polish, you know, American, but I have a Polish heritage. And then I found out later that the Polish were the ones that created the Special Operations Forces. The whole notion of Special Operations Forces were created by the Polish during the Second World War. And to this day, I'm told they do it as good, if not better, than the Americans.
That's amazing, Chris. I'm going to jump in just because we have to take a break in a second. But I'm so glad that you shared that story. And, you know, I'm sorry you had to deal with that as a young kid. But it's so interesting to hear your own journey to self-acceptance about your own cultural heritage. Myra, I'm curious, are these the kind of stories that you have started to hear as this series came out of folks kind of reckoning with their own stereotypes that they've dealt with?
Absolutely. And I, like, as soon as I heard SKI, I was like, ooh, Polish. I used to live in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, which is a totally Polish neighborhood. And I have never heard that stereotype, that Polish people are stupid. I've definitely heard that black people are stupid, you know, being a pretty prominent stereotype. But that is fascinating. I mean, I think most of us should just take a step back whenever we hear something negative about ourselves or apply to a group of people and try to figure out, A, where it comes from, which is what a lot of this work was, and, you know, what has happened in history to make this apply, to make this stereotype so prevalent or to carry it forward, you know, to what Chris is saying, like, I can't tell really if this is like a writ large stereotype or if this is just some small town, like, you're different than I am thing going on. But either way, it is so good to second guess what other people are saying about large groups of people and then to get curious about it, like, what in the world and where and how?
We're going to expand the conversation now. We are joined in the studio by two people who appear as guests in this series. Marlon Fisher is a stand-up comedian, a military veteran, an educator, and a host of Moth storytelling events in Burlington. He spoke with Myra for her episode on the myth of the deadbeat dad. Marlon, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
Yeah, I'm so glad to have you. I think we've only talked with you on Zoom, so this is the first time we're meeting in person, which is awesome. We are also joined in the studio by Tino Rutenhira. He's the executive director of the Vermont Professionals of Color Network, and he appeared on the Homegoings episode about the myth of the stupid black person. Tino, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we're so glad to have both of you. And listeners, you can join the conversation as well. 800-639-2211 is our number. Marlon, first, I'm curious, what was your first reaction when Myra approached you saying, I want to talk to you about this subject, this myth, this stereotype? What did it bring up for you?
Yeah, I think at first there was a different path we were going.
Yeah, we started an interview about a whole different episode and then ended up here because of what you said.
Wow.
But
yeah, so we started about what it means to be free as a black man, and then it ended up being me being a black, talking about me being a black father. And so it brought up a lot. you know, my relationship with my father, my siblings' relationship with my father, and then when my and then me being a father itself with my kids, and so and what I've been through, my personal experience, and why I continue to show up. And it was really that, I think, was validating as I was like listening to my story and my narrative, why I continue to show up for my children as their dad.
Mm. And Tino, you were in a different episode, but you're also a father, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I saw in your profile on the Vermont Professionals of Color Network website that you said your proudest achievement is being a dad to your 18-year-old
daughter? She is now 19 years old.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is by far my proudest achievement, and also a single parent as well. So I was reflecting and thinking about when I was listening to Marlon's episode about, you know, the myth of the deadbeat dad and how, you know, we aren't expected as Black men to show up as being family men, as being parents who care, as being people that have genuine and intimate relationships with our children.
Mm. Yeah. Marlon, you brought up your own relationship with your father. How much do you feel like that relationship shaped how you approached parenthood when you became a dad?
Yes, my father was out of the picture for most of my life up until I had my first son. So it shaped it in a way where I knew what not to do, right? I knew what I wanted to do, and that was to be present. And, you know, now that my father is, you know, we talk weekly now, and these are some of the things that we sort of talk about. I say, hey, guess what? I got to lay in bed with my oldest son and just have a conversation, which I never had done as an 8-year-old or 6-year-old. And I always say to my kids, like, you know what? I don't know what this feels like from your perspective. I have no idea what it feels like. So those are the things that we talk about, and that's what shapes my relationship with my two sons now.
Mm. What's it like bringing that up with your father? It must be difficult
yes,
for both of you.
my father is a dude from the city, the hood. You know, 19. You know, born in the late 60s, and he, you know, I've done a lot of work, a lot of therapy, a lot of work on myself, and I think that's something that I am driving him to do. I tell him that I'm not his therapist, even though he'll rant for 15 minutes. I'm like, that's what therapy is, you know. so it just sort of helps. I think my dad's eyes are opening up to, you know, receiving the internal work. So
yeah.
It's really, really good.
Yeah. Tino, where did you kind of shape your own ideas of fatherhood? Is this something that is being a father something you modeled after what you experienced as a child with your own dad, or did you have to kind of forge your own path, sort of like Marlon said?
Yeah, I think I had to forge my own path. Parenting I'm from Zimbabwe originally, and in our culture, the role of the father isn't the way that it is here in America, or at least in Western culture. My dad was a provider, a producer, somebody who went and what's the term, like, made the bacon, killed the bacon?
Yeah.
Something about the bacon.
Something about bacon.
Something about bacon. I love bacon. So
brought it home. Brought home the bacon.
There you go. And I know my dad loved me. I know he showed that by bringing home the bacon, literally. And so I never really had, we never talked about love, the concept of love, with my dad. And yet I know and I knew that he loved me. Whereas now that I'm a dad here in America, and the expectations of how to parent here are completely different. And so I had to learn on my own. However, I think the concept of love transcends cultures. So you can show your love in multiple ways, and you don't need to have stereotypes or cultural references to know how to love somebody, you know. And so for me, I fell in love with my daughter the minute I saw her, you know, when I laid eyes on her when she was born. And it changed my life. It changed everything I felt about how to show up in the world, how I wanted to show up for her in the world. And it was unfortunate that my marriage at the time ended, but the care and the love that I have for my daughter, it transcended all of that.
Mm.
Yeah.
I've not cried. We had a bunch of weepy parents in the studio today.
I know. And the the saddest thing I can think of is that just the color of your skin, both of you, you're presumed, stereotyped to be deadbeat dads. You probably left your kids. You probably don't provide. And then you just listen, just listening, like you said at the top of this, like the art of listening, just take the time to know people and listen, hear these beautiful stories. And they're like the sweetest dads ever. And I'm crying. Wonderful.
Let's go to the phones. We have a couple folks calling in for this conversation that we're having today about stereotypes. Kermit is calling in from Wyndham. Kermit, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm black. I'm North African, so sometimes people assume I'm not black, but I'm black. I was raised in the western side of the country on a ranch, so I'm completely familiar with racism, very familiar with its tones of voice and all of these stereotypes that you're discussing. But what I wanted to talk about, just uniquely Vermont, maybe, something I've been experiencing here, I've been here since 95, is that when you're sort of the assimilated Negro, there's a level of disrespect that people who are openly hostile to black people, they may be less so if they find you threatening or if you look like you might come from Central Africa or West Africa or might seem to be blacker. So they might not be as disrespectful. But one of the phenomena that we are dealing with right now, with all of the folks moving here from New Jersey and Connecticut and Long Island, people who move here and interact with you, the level of their disrespect is just off the charts. The tone of voice, the barking, and when you try and describe what's going on to your fellow Vermonters who are white, who've never experienced any racial stress, they don't really know how to even react to it, because they might think that it's all in your head, or they just don't even really know how to comprehend what you're saying. But it's pretty serious. Mm-hmm. They also will use the police to police you, police your animals. It's pretty distressing.
Mm. And Kermit, I'm so sorry you've experienced that, but I'm so appreciative you called in to share and to add your voice. I'd really like to hear from the folks in this room about what Kermit's experience brings up for you, Marlon. I'm wondering if you could start us out.
Oh man, Kermit, I definitely feel you on the use of policing to police you. As I have been experiencing that recently, I think I just want to validate your experience. I think that's all I can say right now. That brings up a lot for me hearing that. Knowing that I'm not the only one going through this, I know that. Let's figure out a way to connect, Kermit. Let's figure out a way to connect. I'd love to have a conversation with you offline at some point if we can.
Mm. And Tina, one of the central parts of your life is connecting folks of color in Vermont to share those types of stories, right? Could you tell us a little bit about your work?
Yeah. So I'm the co-founder and co-executive director of the Vermont Professionals of Color Network, and our organization exists to improve the social, economic, and professional experience, representation, and success of BIPOC professionals and entrepreneurs in the state. And just to kind of chat a little bit about what Kermit said,
yeah.
I think the lack of racial diversity in Vermont doesn't correlate to a lack of racism in Vermont. Racism is real in Vermont, and we experience it in all sorts of ways, whether it is through the criminal justice system, policing, the education system, and so on. So I think there's a lot of potential here in Vermont for folks to learn about what it's really like to live life as a person of color, and to really sort of start to embrace the fact that, like, just because we live in a quote-unquote liberal state, doesn't mean that the systems and the experiences that are out there are not real for folks of color. And yeah, I think it's a great injustice, the fact that we're in 2024, and yet there are things that have been debunked as well as unproven for probably hundreds of years now that are still being held as factual.
Mm. Well, let's bring in some more voices from our region on this topic. We have Michelle in Rutland calling in. Michelle, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I was once married to a black man, and we had a son together. And I often found when my child was young and we were out together that people, if you don't match, people feel like they have the right to come up to you and ask you about your adoption, which is very offensive. This is a complete stranger that is asking you these questions. And so that was one comment that was really always hard to imagine, as if you can't be in a mixed marriage and have a child. Mm. And the other comment I think about how black men are exploited is through the sports industry. We're not afraid to see athletes, you know, really pound down the fields or whatever they do with full strength. But we're afraid to walk by them on the street or get in an elevator with them because they're tall. I find that just so disheartening.
Hmm. Well, yeah, Michelle, thank you. Thank you for calling in. What you're saying kind of brings up for me, Myra, as some of the points that you made in the episode about the myth of the scary black man. And I want to play a clip from that and then have you respond to it after that. This is Chris Brown of Colchester, who we had on Vermont Edition recently. And here he's talking about an experience that he had as a landlord as he was applying to be a tenant.
And I remember I begged my landlord. I was like, look, man, I told my family to stay in the car and I took them away. And I was like, look, man, I don't have nowhere. I don't have nothing else. Like, this is all I got. Like, please let me stay here. I was like, I'll do anything. He was like, I'm not really for sure. But then I had backing, military backing and help, you know, to get me in a place. And I remember he stood in my living room or our living room because I was just renting the property. And he was like, I don't know how you going to stay here. I don't see how you going to live here and pay your rent. So y'all don't get too comfortable. And he said it in front of my family. And he was like standing face to face and he was like, just don't get too comfortable. And like, it struck a fire in me because I was like, how dare you say that to me? But, you know, I wasn't really in a position to be like, how dare you? You know, I was barely getting in a place, you know, and I had to do what I had to do. I had to swallow that pride and show and prove.
Myra, tell us a little bit more about that conversation with Chris that you had.
Yeah, Chris is, he's quite tall. Mm-hmm. He's quite big, and you hear his voice. I mean, Barry White is jealous of mm-hmm. that voice. Okay, it is so low. And he has had some stereotypes that have been applied to him that are super unfair because of it. And we just heard about, you know, what it was like for him to even get a place with his family, right? Just like living, just normal stuff like where you live. And he is, because you nicknamed me Nuance Flynn at the start of the show.
I did.
He has something interesting going on too, where his stereotype that's been applied to him has sometimes been true. And I think that's something that we have to look at too. He's in the episode called The Myth of the Scary Black Man. A lot of the fear of black men that has come out in today's modern society, aside from the hundreds of years of history of it, is the fear that a lot of black men were once incarcerated and then released out into the streets. And they're all going to just like keep, you know, being in gangs and selling drugs and doing all these things. Well, Chris was previously incarcerated. He was incarcerated for not only selling drugs, but for robbing drug dealers in some sort of like a Robin Hood kind of effort way, right? And then stopped and went to culinary school and got it all together and had a family. And he's kind of the coolest flex of the stereotype anti-type series because he then went on, and this is all pot, mind you, back when it was illegal. And then he went on to start a podcast. He does voiceover work about cannabis. So follow that full circle. It's just so wild. It's also a great example of how you can turn some of the things that people think about you into a kind of a superpower sometimes.
Yeah. I want to dive right back into the phones. We have another call here from Alan in Burlington. Alan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I just kind of wanted, I think I wanted to address this. Is it Tina that is from Zimbabwe?
Tino?
Yes.
Well, I had just met a couple from Zimbabwe very recently at a film festival, and the woman of the couple was telling me that it's customary in it's custom in Zimbabwe that after the birth of the child, the first 8 weeks, she goes directly to her mother and gives the child to her mother where she cares for the both of them. And I thought, what a wonderful thing to learn. And what a wonderful way to come into life.
Hmm. Alan, thanks for calling in. I think you're referencing a part of our conversation earlier where Tino was talking about his upbringing, your upbringing, Tino, and how it's different. Expectations around fatherhood are different in different countries. I don't know too much about this. Is this something that you grew up with?
Yes, it is something that is practiced. But I think it's something that even here in Western culture should be practiced because we all need to help each other. We all need family supports. And it doesn't exclude the dad from being in the picture. It's really just utilizing or taking advantage of the fact that the mom has, the mother of the woman that's given birth mm-hmm. has already been a mom. And so it's like just helping her with that first initial phase of child rearing.
Mm. Yeah. Well, thanks for calling in with your experience, Alan. And if you have thoughts to share about our conversation, 800-639-2211 is our number. Since we're talking, these episodes are about all sorts of things, but we've been talking a lot about fatherhood and parenting here. And I want to kind of draw that out a little bit more. When we're talking about these stereotypes, I'm really curious if these are things that you have brought up with your own kids, talking to them about the stereotypes they might encounter about themselves or about other people in their communities and what those conversations are like. Marlon, let's start with you.
Yeah, well, first, I was thinking about the earlier part of the episode where we were talking about penis sizes. And I, as a comedian, tell this joke about my kids, and it makes me think like I probably shouldn't be telling that joke, right? Because I play off of the stereotype. And when with my kids, we spend a lot of time, and I really haven't broached the topic of stereotypes with them, but we spend a lot of time talking about like what it means to be black. On the car ride to school, we listen to Black Affirmations for Black Affirmations for Black Boys, which is like we're up to like 700 and something now in the car. But I just want them to understand. I really work on helping them understand like who they are as black boys and eventually black men, even though they're biracial. But and you look at them, they're black. And so that's where I focus on is just like making sure they understand that their identity. Because for a long time, the way I grew up was, Brooklyn, New York to a summer camp in Westchester to boarding school to, all white school. And that was my life for most of it. And so my identity was mostly like the token black guy, right? And so I want my kids to understand they're going to be black throughout their entire lives, and that's what they need to embrace. And we're doing that together. Like we're taking that journey together.
Mm. So. Yeah. Tito, what about you? Do you talk about this with your daughter?
Absolutely. And my daughter's older than Marlon's kids, significantly. Mm-hmm. And so we've had those conversations about, hair and, a black woman's body and how maybe sometimes women's bodies, particularly black women's bodies, are either hypersexualized or undersexualized. And the whole notion of the strong black woman, and the fact that, like, you're just a woman and don't try to make yourself out to be what the world tells you. And then also on top of that, I've had, and talking about sort of parenting and myths and so on, having the talk with my child. And so you guys, you're probably thinking the talk about the birds and the bees, but no, this is the talk about how to react when you're stopped by the police. And I don't think a lot of white people in Vermont have had that conversation with my then, at that time, 15, 16-year-old daughter. And yet I'm having this conversation with my daughter, and not to, again, create a stereotype, but this is a girl that we're talking about as opposed to maybe a 16-year-old boy. And so why am I having that conversation with a 16-year-old girl about how to act when you're stopped by the police? And those are some of the like the difficult conversations that we as people of color have to have, particularly Black people, about having these about having interactions with folks like the police.
Yeah, I just not just the police, but just like people in general. I mean, I think about this incident where last week where I had my youngest son home with me. He was homesick. We had to go pick up a prescription at the pharmacy, and we were waiting to get it. And it was a Black woman just sitting off on the corner, and you know, I don't know. She got up, and there was another customer who made eye contact with her, and he looked at me and says, "Is she with you?" And I'm like, why would you assume that she is with me? And now I have to be conscious of the fact that my 6-year old is about to watch me react to this. And I react in a way that like really holds this guy account, holds this gentleman accountable for saying, assuming that this person is with me. And I think that's the other way that I teach my kids. Like, I think my kids have seen me in the moment when like I might be being followed around a store, but see me in the moment sort of stop and address whatever the issue is in an appropriate way. Where instead of going home and like sitting in it and like, man, another moment where someone did something racist towards me. And so my kids get to see that and experience that, and they're learning how to react. And we do a lot of follow up on those conversations when those things happen. So I think that's really, like what Tito said, just really important to them. Yeah.
And it's tough because like there's this level of excellence that you always have to be hitting all the time as a person of color. And that bar keeps getting raised higher and higher every time because there's no time for mistakes and there's no leeway for people to mess up, because every time you mess up, then you're another case of, you see, we gave Black people a chance and they screwed up, or we, you know, we told you that Black people are stupid, or whatever it is that the myths are. And it is difficult, and it is very frustrating, and it is very tiring.
Exhausting.
Yeah. Mara, what's this for you?
I'm just listening. Yeah, and I'm just so thankful. I'm so thankful for all the folks who have called in. I just want to say, like, it seems like we really got a conversation going here, and this is stuff that needs to be talked about more frequently, which is why Homegoings exist in the first place. But also just listening to the nuance of these stories, absolutely. And, you know, the Jezebel trope, which is a stereotype that applies to Black women that I've definitely suffered, you know, from my whole life. And listening to Marlon's example, I think the other day, somebody came up to me and said, so you're a singer? And I said, yeah. And they're like, great. So what kind of R&B do you sing? And I kind of wanted to just be like, well, it's actually country music. That's my thing. But then that'd be a lie, because I do sing soul music. Fine. OK. And sometimes they apply. But I think it's just really inappropriate to assume. And then also, if you do assume, you should understand the implications of that assumption, because to Tino's point, to Marlon's point, it is exhausting to spend a lifetime trying to disprove these stereotypes that you were just born with. You've inherited them. And I think Tino's story was really fascinating, the myth of the stupid Black person, to listen to, because he's from Zimbabwe. He's from a place where these stereotypes are not inherent. He had to learn them by slamming into them as a young man coming to America and being like, wait, what? Like, I've got like 20 degrees and you won't even give me a job at your local deli, you know? And just the assumption of stupidity that had followed him until, you know, finally somebody gave him a chance, in which he, you know, we are also so proud of who we are, and sometimes too proud to say to our fellow white colleague, Michaela LaFrac, you know, white woman friend of mine, sometimes it does take you also calling out some of the stuff you're seeing, or extending a hand and seeing me to bring me into the light of what you experience every day, so that I can have the same shot and have the same opportunities. Because I would love to just show up and just kill it all day, every day. But I've got this bag of shadows that I'm carrying with me everywhere I go. And they're full of trauma, and they're full of stereotypes, and they're full of assumptions. And just for me to put one foot in front of the other every day is so different than it is for you. And so, can you help me? You know, can you help people see me better? And that's a hard conversation to have. You don't even want to have to ask for it, but that's the way society is structured. So it's also really, really great when white people can call out the stereotypes that they're seeing and be like, oh, Myra, yeah, she sings country music. You can just tell people I sing
country. All
right,
everyone, Myra Flynn is a country music star. Nominate her for CMA.
I've got my dress.
Doing the work. Yes, Tino.
So having, I was reflecting on this and we're having a walk with somebody, a white person, and they were talking about like the episodes and particularly my episode about the stupid black man. And they were talking about how like, well, but then there's people with disabilities that are discriminated against. There's women and LGBTQ and so on. And so I think in retrospect, when I think about it, like we have to lead with race. We have to lead with the fact that it is people of color, black people in particular, that are experiencing a lot of that trauma and a lot of the dysfunctioning of the system. And that, if we solve those, because those are the places where you see inequities in education, in healthcare, in the criminal justice system, in housing, if we can solve those things for the black and brown community, then we're also solving them for women and for poor white people and for, you know, people with disabilities and so on, because we have to lead with race. And that is where a lot of the inequities start. And in all of those things that I mentioned, you will find those inequities in rooted in racism. And so I think that this country was built on the backs of a lot of black slaves and folks of color. And that's where a lot of these issues come up. And so we have to address those issues first in order to then overcome some of those other societal issues.
Hmm. We have just about a minute left. Marlon, do you have any final thoughts to share?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think about my story in particular, and right, I agree, 100% agree with you, Tito. That's exactly, I'm going to say this, I feel you there. But just, you know, from a role of my, like why my episode and being a father and, you know, what's been really helpful is I've been able to use my experience to, you know, support other dads, black dads, white moms, you know, everybody as any parent. And it really has taught me to like, remember to walk this life with like integrity and character, like believe in myself, because our kids see us and, they're the best judges of character and they know, that's why I continue to love them and continue to again, show up and be present. So if all the parents are listening, just show up the best way you can. You're never going to be 100% as a parent. That's it. You're never 100%.
Amen.
And to teach your kids not to hold these assumptions about other people as well. I love taking my daughter to the Korean spa in Los Angeles where no bathing suits are allowed. And there's all sorts of women there and all sorts of bodies and colors and shapes and sizes. And she doesn't ask questions about people's bodies or anything anymore because she's so familiarized with them. So that kind of level of exposure, not saying you have to do that, but just saying whatever kind of level of exposure that means for you as a parent is so key, I think, to erasing and eradicating some of these very old and harmful stereotypes.
Well, let me end with an email that we got from a listener during today's show, a listener in Montpelier, who writes, I am a man of mixed race. My father was black. I myself pass for white. And I just want to thank Myra for doing this research. This person brings up the first episode that we talked about at the start of the show, The Myth of the Big Black Penis. And they say, I wonder how people have just seemed to casually talk about it and not realize that they're being offensive. And this person really appreciated you bringing this conversation out into the open. You can find Myra Flynn's full series on stereo anti-types on the Homegoings podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts, or on vermontpublic.org. You can also check out all the other episodes that are coming out from Homegoings. There's so many great ones. Myra Flynn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michaela. It was so great being here with all of you.
Yeah, we were also joined by Marlon Fisher. Marlon, thank you.
Thank you, Michaela. Thank you.
And Tino Rutenhira.
Thank you, Michaela. Thank you, Myra.
All right, that is all the time we have for today's show. It was directed by Mary Angish. Our producers are John Ahrens, Andrea Lorien, and Daniela Fierro. Rick Barrett was our call screener. Who recorded this theme music, Myra?
I did.
It was you. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.